United States v. Taylor, 09-2575. We'll hear from Mr. McKinley. Good morning.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is James McKinley. I'm an attorney with the Federal Public Defender's Office in Indianapolis. Darrell Taylor is serving a term of 37 years in a U.S. penitentiary after being convicted of brandishing a short-barreled rifle during the course of two convenience store stick-ups when he was 21 years old. Given in part because of his lack of any criminal history, he was released prior to trial and directed to reside at a community correction center, the Volunteers of America, in Indianapolis. He resided there for the 13 months preceding trial, during which time, you know, he did well. He had a job. He was well-liked, and he's compliant with the terms and conditions of his release. While a resident at the VOA, he was befriended by a man by the name of Dale Seary. Mr. Seary was a lay pastor who conducted religious services attended by the defendant. And at trial, in this case, during the defense case in chief, we called Dale Seary. We called him as a character witness to testify as to his opinion and as to Mr. Taylor's reputation for truthfulness, veracity, for honesty, and, of course, with an eye toward getting into other character traits such as peacefulness, law-abidingness, all of which we would then argue, of course, that they are traits that are inconsistent with those possessed by a person who would commit a robbery. Now, after laying a foundation for asking for, in fact, I asked the question as to the witness's opinion about Mr. Taylor's reputation, it was met with an objection from the government for hearsay, at which point the court directed the parties to a bench conference, and the court, without addressing the hearsay objection, basically says, no, this is not character testimony, because, you know, for two reasons. Number one, the witness didn't know the defendant at the time the offense occurred, and number two, the relevant community was too small. It was just a small community of residents at the VOA. And so I was told, you know, this does not qualify as character evidence. And I explained that, okay, I was also going to be attempting to elicit the opinion of this particular witness, you know, his own personal opinion. And again, because he had not known the defendant at the time the offense occurred, the judge ruled, specifically said, quote, you can't ask that, counsel. That is not character evidence. And, again, challenging the questioning the relevancy because the witness did not know Mr. Taylor at the time that the crime occurred. So I went to my fallback position. That is, well, it's certainly relevant in connection with my client's credibility. In other words, I should be permitted to introduce this to assist the jury in assessing my client's credibility, basically bolstering my client's credibility. And the judge agreed, but said, because your client hasn't testified, we're going to have this witness stand by and wait until after the defendant has testified. And the judge said, and I quote again, otherwise it's not an issue here because the witness did not know defendant at the time the offense occurred. So she ruled that the witness could testify, but only if the defendant took the stand, and at that point the witness could only testify about my client's testimony. Now, after this colloquy occurred at the bench conference, I conferred with my client, who all of a sudden changed his mind about testifying. He declined to testify. At that point, I had no choice but to withdraw the witness, which I did. And to the extent that this character testimony was proffered to lend credibility to my client's believability should he take the stand, I have no choice but to concede that we've probably waived any claim of error based on my client's decision not to take the stand. But understand, that is not the only reason that this testimony was proffered. We were simultaneously attempting to elicit both reputation and opinion testimony of pertinent character traits, including truthfulness and honesty, and eventually peacefulness and law-abidingness, for the purpose of arguing later that these are character traits that would be inconsistent with a person who would commit a robbery. The government has argued waiver here. There was no waiver of this argument, nor has there been forfeiture of this argument. If there were, I would assert we still this still rises to the level of plain error, but there's no forfeiture of the issue here. The issue is to be decided using an abuse of discretion standard. And I submit that the judge's discretion here was exercised based on a fundamental misapprehension of how Rule 405 and Rule 404 apply here. First of all, Rule 404 only requires, the only limitation on character testimony and testimony concerning character traits is that it be pertinent, that it be relevant to the issue. And character traits of truthfulness, honesty, law-abidingness, peacefulness are all relevant. They are all pertinent and are appropriate for the jury to consider.
McKinley, what's wrong with the judge's conclusion that, look, this is all good behavior after he's arrested and after he's charged, so it really doesn't have much value to the jury?
The answer to that is this, Judge. The Rule 404 does not require that the witness know a person a particular amount of time, or that the person know the reputation at the time in a situation where the offense is committed. Now, as far as the value of the testimony, yes, the fact that it was all that his opinions are based on familiarity with the defendant after the offense, that's certainly something that may make the testimony less persuasive, but it's an issue of the weight to be afforded that testimony, not the admissibility. Certainly the government would be free to cross-examine and point out and eventually argue, hey, your opinion on these character traits or the reputation is based on post-defense conduct, which, again, makes it perhaps less powerful. But it doesn't render it inadmissible. The rule here does not impose any requirement on the individual to know the person he's testifying about at the time that the offense occurred. Moreover, there is not any limitation contained in the rule that requires, that the relevant community in which the reputation is created be a certain size. Granted, this is a small community, but again, the fact that it was a small community is an issue that bears on the weight of this evidence, but certainly not its admissibility. Now, the impact of this ruling on the defense here, I can't understate this. It was significant. We admittedly had little to work with here, particularly in light of Mr. Taylor's decision all of a sudden not to testify. But as the Supreme Court has acknowledged, character testimony by itself can be sufficient to create reasonable doubt. This is all I had. And that the significance of this testimony took on a new role following my client's decision not to testify. Basically, this was going to be the defense. We were denied that opportunity to argue that. And for that reason, this cannot be harmless error. This was error that warrants reversal and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. McKinley. Mr. Rinka?
May it please the Court, Mr. McKinley, Mr. Cook, good morning. I'm Matthew Rink on behalf of the United States. The evidence in this case that was offered with respect to with respect to a character trait of the defendant, Mr. Taylor, was offered for a very, very limited purpose at trial. the very limited purpose is clear in the record of the colloquy between the district judge and defense counsel. This very specific, tailored questions that the district judge was asking were directed at determining for what purpose this evidence was being offered. And the district court correctly concluded, based on the questions that the court asked and the answers that defense counsel gave, that this particular testimony, for the very specific purpose that it was offered, was not relevant unless and until the defendant testified. Now, to clarify, in the colloquy between the court and defense counsel, the question was raised, well, what is the relevance? The district court specifically says, you have to link this up for me. What is the relevance of this testimony? And the response that the court receives is that, and this is a quote, Your Honor, my client is, it's my understanding my client is going to take the stand. Clearly his truthfulness is a key issue. So it is the truthful, the court's question, so is this truthful testimony you are trying to buttress? Yes, Your Honor. Not any statements he made at the time of the offense. Not with regard to statements made at the time of the offense, no, but with regard to his honesty today in taking the stand. In that colloquy between the district court and defense counsel very narrowly limited the purpose for which he sought to elicit this testimony from the pastor of the Volunteers of America.
Mr. Rinka, if the purpose had been articulated more generally, just to show good character for peacefulness, honesty, etc., do you think it should have been admitted? I'm not asking you whether it was harmless or not, but I'm asking you whether you think it should have been
admitted. For the sake of argument, Judge, no. And here's why. We then absolutely move from Rule 608 back to the Rule 404 analysis, and we're looking really at, is this pertinent? Is what this gentleman is going to say pertinent? And I would again highlight for the court that when you look at this, we're talking only about, he's only talking about his truthfulness, only about his truthfulness. And so then, again, the district court is inquiring, well, this is all post-arrest. This isn't with respect to any statements he made at the time of the offense, which has already come into evidence. This is only with respect to his truthfulness at the VOA.
He had to disavow the statement that he made at the time of the arrest, right? He had to, the defense had to wind up saying as a practical matter that he was not being honest when he admitted to the offense, correct?
Correct. And truthfulness and, excuse me, law-abidingness, peacefulness, those issues never came up before the district court, ever. It was simply a discussion about whether or not this witness, and ultimately, as you read through the transcript, it became more and more clear where defense counsel was going, and that was he wanted this particular witness to say that if the defendant took the stand and swore an oath, this witness, Mr. Siri, would believe the defendant's testimony on oath. And there was a discussion about case law, and ultimately the district court decided, look, okay, but that has to wait. This is a very, very limited purpose for what this was offered. Now, at the time the defendant decided he wasn't going to take the stand and testify, if there was some other testimony that the court had not addressed, some other theory of admissibility that defense counsel had for why this testimony was pertinent under Rule 404, counsel was obligated to make the court aware of that so we could have a discussion about what pertinence there was, law-abidingness, peacefulness, but that never came up. Even after Darryl Taylor decided not to testify, a strategic decision that he made, the underlying reasoning for which we are left to speculate about at best, the issue becomes, under 404, this testimony was never offered to establish law-abidingness. It was never offered to establish peacefulness. And, of course, even if it was, we would have had the same discussion about pertinence. How is this witness able to formulate a basis for testifying about reputation for truth, for law-abidingness or peacefulness when all of his knowledge of this defendant post-dates the arrest. Now, that's not a without which not. It's simply a how is this pertinent? How are we going to get there? But, of course, we never did because it was never offered for either of those purposes. And, again, the government would argue, as it has in its brief, that even if it had been offered for those purposes, it would not have been pertinent. And the government, as it's cited in its brief, finds strong support for that position in the United States v. Hill case, where you're talking about the defense trying to introduce evidence of a defendant's failure to basically engage in the same conduct that they were charged with, and this court saying, you know what, that's post-arrest. Post-arrest, when the defendant knows they're under investigation, these are the things we expect of them. We expect they're not going to engage in the same criminal conduct. That's not pertinent. And the government would urge this court to adopt a similar stance with respect to any proffered potential testimony of what Mr. Siri might have testified to if his testimony was offered for those purposes, which, of course, it was not. But, and again, we're left to speculate about what possibly he could have testified to. But at the end of the day, even assuming that it was offered for that purpose, it would not have been pertinent. And with respect to the issue of the relevant community size, I respectfully disagree with Mr. McKinley's interpretation of what the court was getting at in suggesting that this is post-arrest. He's only known him at the VOA. He's only been able to talk to people at the VOA that Daryl Taylor has interacted with. It is not the district court limiting the size of the community. It's the district court inquiring of defense counsel, how is this a basis or a foundation upon which this gentleman can testify and establish that he truly has testimony that is pertinent to a character trait of this defendant? I would suggest that at the end of the day, when one looks at the full record in this case, the colloquy certainly between the district court and defense counsel and the overwhelming evidence that the government presented at trial with respect to this particular defendant's guilt, we see two things. One, if Mr. Siri had testified as Mr. McKinley wanted him to, and Daryl Taylor subsequently failed to take the stand, a completely strategic decision, again, the reasoning of which it's very difficult to speculate about, that testimony would have had the very obvious and peculiar effect of buttressing the earlier evidence that the government put in about statements Daryl Taylor made to the police at the time of his arrest. In other words, if Mr. Siri testified that, you know, yes, Daryl Taylor is a truthful person, I would believe him, and Daryl Taylor decided he wasn't going to take the stand, here we have an hour-plus worth of audio recording of Daryl Taylor admitting to these crimes. Mr. Siri's testimony would have actually buttressed Daryl Taylor's confession to the police. In other words, the effect on this case would have been, it would have not have had the effect that Mr. McKinley suggested, and the effect to create reasonable doubt. In fact, it would have had the effect of buttressing the evidence that the government had already presented.
I suspect Mr. McKinley's clients have not always taken his good advice.
Indeed, Your Honor. But this is the issue, Judge. You know, this is the issue that we get into with the speculating about why the individual decided not to testify at the last minute. One can only guess. It could also be a very strategic decision on the client's part alone, and a decision aimed solely at interjecting just this very kind of debate that we're having into a trial record that was otherwise very clean. And the government would urge this court to consider that as well, because we can't get into Daryl Taylor's mind at this point. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rinko. You have a little time for rebuttal, Mr. McKinley.
I would urge the court to review very carefully the bench conference, which is included in the transcript of the bench conference, which is included in our brief, because I think what you will see, what emerges from that colloquy, is a sequence that's in stark contrast to what the government has described, in the sense that as soon as I attempted to elicit this information, the judge made it very clear, look, this witness didn't know the defendant at the time the offense occurred, and the reputation is based on post-defense information, and therefore it's not character evidence, period. Now, when the government says, hey, I offered this evidence only for this very limited, specific purpose of bolstering the credibility, again, that's kind of my backup position. The judge had already made it very clear that based on the size of the community and because the witness had only known my client post-defense, I wasn't going to be permitted to introduce that testimony. I respectfully disagree with the government's description of this being inadmissible. This was clearly admissible. Yeah. There is nothing in the rule to prohibit this testimony from coming in.
Thank you. Mr. McKinley?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.